Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, accidents to watch out for on the 101 eastbound on the Scottsdale Road on-ramp, 101 southbound in the West Valley at Bethany Home, and on the 202 northbound Red Mountain Freeway at University. Look for partly cloudy skies tonight. Slight chance of rain, overnight lows in the low to mid-70s. 40% chance of storms tomorrow with a high of 91. Sunny on Sunday with a high of 94 degrees. It's sunny at 93 right now at KJZZ. The U.S. Interior Department has come up with a way to manage the Glen Canyon Dam for the next two decades. The plan released today would provide water and power for its many customers in the West while attempting to protect the environment in the Grand Canyon downstream. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
When water is released from the dam to create hydropower, beaches along the Colorado River erode, leaving little habitat for endangered fish or protection for cultural resources. In recent years, dam operators have released high flows in attempts to rebuild some of the beaches. Under the new plan, the federal government will continue the high flows and replace some of the fish that have died. The seven states that rely on the Colorado River as a water source, the power companies, and the Navajo Nation have supported the new plan. But environmentalists, including Save the Colorado, say the impact statement doesn't comply with federal law. The group says the new plan would not recover the endangered fish, and it doesn't address climate change impacts on the river. The Interior Department will make a final record of decision after a month-long public review. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Ballots will start hitting mailboxes in the next several days in advance of November's election, and of course voters are interested in the presidential race as well as ones for U.S. Senate and Congress, among others. But the State Bar of Arizona is encouraging you to look beyond the big races and vote on whether or not to retain judges. Rick DeBruhl is the bar's chief communications officer, and Rick, it seems like this is kind of an every 2 year kind of effort to try to remind slash convince voters that the election isn't just about casting ballots for a president or governor, but that all the way at the bottom of the ballot, they decide on judges as well.
Yeah, our campaign is called Finish the Ballot, because we want people to not just vote for the governor or the president, but actually look at the back end, because it really is significant. I mean, it's our system of justice. And Arizona voters back in 1974 came up with a system called merit selection. It means that judges aren't directly elected, because if you think about it, that's kind of a dangerous thing, especially, you know, in small counties it's done that way. But in Pima, Pinal, and Maricopa counties, we do it through what's called merit selection. We try to find the best judges. Judges on merit are then selected. But they still have to stand for what's called a retention election. And the voters get a chance to say, you know what, this guy is good or this guy is bad, and then they get to vote him off. And back in the 90s, voters also approved a system called judicial performance review. It's a way that judges are judged, and it's done through a panel, and it's a great way, because voters aren't, for the most part, going to know anything about a judge. It's a great way to learn and to get that information and have somebody do the homework for you.
Yeah, is this kind of a dual problem that you're trying to solve here, both trying to remind voters that they can vote and should vote on judges, but also where do they get the information?
Exactly, because it's useless to tell people, please vote, if they don't have the information. The website is azjudges.info, and you go there, it's the Judicial Performance Review. They've already done the rankings, and this year, there is one particular judge in Maricopa County who did not meet the retention standard. And as an organization, we're not going to tell people they should vote for or against this particular judge. But what we do believe is that voters should make an informed choice.
And there is precedent for this, right? I mean, there has been a judge who was not retained.
Yeah, it's interesting because up until 2014, there had not been a judge who lost a retention election since 1978. And the opponents of the system who believe in elections for judges say, well, that just shows it doesn't work. So we launched this campaign in 2014 called Finish the Ballot. We had a cute little video that we have on our website, that kind of thing, really to inform people. And for the first time in 36 years, the voters actually did not retain a judge here in Maricopa County as a result of finding the information and voting with an informed decision.
The conventional wisdom is often that as you go down the ballot, the number of people who are voting in a given election dwindles. You know, go from president down to Congress, down to legislature, all that stuff. So for judicial retention elections, are we talking about a pretty small number of voters who are deciding these things?
Relatively speaking, yes. Although, once again, we would argue that in 2014, we saw a greater number of people voting. What was really impressive in 2014, so there was one judge in Maricopa County, Judge Norris, Benjamin Norris, who got a do not retain ranking, and the voters did not choose to put him back on the bench. He didn't pass. There was another judge, Judge Gerald Porter, who, while he did get the ranking, he had a number of no votes. He barely passed with 51% of the vote. There really wasn't much conversation about Judge Porter at all. No one was really putting his name out in stories. And yet the voters obviously went through, read the information, and took enough time to say, a number of 49% said, I don't think so.
But is that 49% comprised, do you think, of lawyers and other people sort of in the judicial community who know about these judges and know about some of these issues, or are they, you know, regular Joes who have no experience with the justice system?
I think if that was the case, then we would have had judges who had been voted out in earlier years. I think this was the first time that I think we were able to get the voters to stand up and say, okay, I can get the information, I can make an informed decision. Do I think that it's a lot of lawyers making those votes? Most definitely. And we have a campaign where we reach out to lawyers to say, we know your family members, we know your friends are going to come to you asking the information. Here's where you can go to get the information as well. We try to inform lawyers so they can help inform their family and friends.
Do you find this more of a challenge in presidential election years than the alternating years when the statewide offices are up?
You know, this is only the second time we've run the campaign, so we did it 2 years ago. I would say, yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to feel that the presidential race sucks all the air out of the room. I think once people, you know, put that stamp on at the very beginning, they're going to kind of feel exhausted. And, you know, but people are, you know, there's an awful lot of races beyond that. And the judges are at the end of the ballot, but there's a lot of things in between that people still need to vote for. I'm hoping that they just spend some time and go through the entire ballot.
Richter Brule is Chief Communications Officer for the State Bar of Arizona. We'll post a link to the judicial rankings at theshow.kjzz.org.
Solar energy and controversy have been sharing a lot of sentences in the past couple of years. Some have been related to the need for Arizona to be more competitive, while others have focused on political campaigns and so-called dark money. An event today, the Arizona Energy Futures Conference, is intended to bring those issues to light and also provide information on demand charges, net metering, and energy choices, among other things. The conference is being hosted by the Arizona Solar Energy Industries Association, and earlier today I spoke with the group's executive director, Lucy Mason, at the conference, and asked her about the roots of the conference and whether disagreements will be addressed.
We are here today to get to the bottom line facts. Are we going to like everything we hear? No, not necessarily, because it's never easy when you have disparate, you know, contentious sorts of types of issues that people are trying to figure out, but yet we haven't taken the time to actually get to the table with all sides and discuss it. And this is where we are right now. My hope for this conference is to bring this high level discussion in here from people who have studied this for years and sometimes decades, and have followed the industry, the solar industries and all the renewables, have followed the utilities and what the issues are, and to actually be able to do something, you know, with our create solutions that actually serve the public. Here in the state of Arizona, we have the great reactor in the sky, and that brings tremendous ability, you know, for us to be able to move the industries into the state of Arizona. To get companies to come to Arizona, we have to have the legislature involved. And we have to create policies that are going to be important for that invitation to the new technology wrapped around solar industries.
Based on the policies that we've had or not had in place, are you concerned that Arizona, at this point at least, is a little bit behind when it comes to solar energy, despite what you talked about, the big thing in the sky?
I am very concerned. We are at a threshold right now. That's why I felt so, and our board felt so important, it was so important to bring this conference together. And we're seeing numbers. We lost, the Arizona solar energy industries lost over 2,200 jobs in 2015. And this is because of policies that utilities did trying to recover their costs that they see that are happening from what solar is having. You know, you have people using less, electricity, and then with net metering, getting a credit back from their on their bill, which is a good deal for the customers. But what is it doing to the utility? That's what we need to uncover and find out. Honestly, not fear, but let's just look at this. The other thing that I'm concerned about is we have got to bring solar industry into the state. And what's happened, though, is, and I've been watching this for the last decade, is that manufacturers of solar panels and all the other implements, you know, implementations that take place and all the other products that go into putting a solar together, a solar panel together. And then there's the contractors, you know, that install them. And then there's the distribution centers. Why aren't they here in Arizona?
How important is this election season and going into 2017 for solar and Arizona's energy future more generally?
The Arizona Corporation Commission race is one that everyone needs to watch. Mostly in the United States, commissioners are appointed. They are not elected. So this is an important election this year. And the reason is because we want fair commissioners there to take in the information from utilities and take in what the interveners who oppose the rate cases and then work out the details. It has to be fair. Like today, I've told everybody, this is not a solar party. This is not a utility party. This is nitty-gritty, get down, let's listen. Maybe we're not going to like what the other person says. It doesn't matter. We have to listen.
Lucy Mason is Executive Director of the Arizona Solar Energy Industries Association. We spoke earlier today at the Arizona Energy Futures Conference.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick. I'm Steve Goldstein.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2016 to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos for his resolute efforts to bring the country's more than 50-year-long civil war to an end.
That's Cassie Coleman-Fiva, chair of the Nobel Committee, announcing this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos. Now, awkward timing, to say the least, from the Nobel Committee here. It was just a few days ago that Colombian voters rejected the referendum that would have ratified the peace deal between the Colombian government and FARC rebels, ending the civil war there. Nonetheless, the prize is awarded, and after that defeat, President Santos and FARC leaders vowed to keep working toward a peace deal. And just today, negotiators for Colombia and the rebel movement in Cuba said they're taking steps to guarantee a lasting ceasefire, and they pledged to listen to those who voted against that peace deal. But Juan Manuel Santos is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Nadia Drost is in Bogota. She's a reporter there. I mentioned some awkward timing. They have a short list for the Nobel Prize that I think is finalized sometime in February or March. So winners could have included aid workers in Syria or even Edward Snowden. Juan Manuel Santos is the winner, but that peace deal is far from settled now.
Absolutely. I think this is a shocker for Colombians, precisely because of the fact that the peace talks have become so derailed. There had been a suspicion beforehand that not only Juan Manuel Santos might be a winner, but that he might be a joint receiver of the Nobel Peace Prize along with the FARC leader Timoshenko. There was also speculation that victims who have been very much a part of the peace process in Cuba might be receiving the prize. So I think that there's not only a shock that Santos has won it, but that he is winning it alone, given that this was an effort on the part of multiple parties. I think that one of the things that Colombians are going to take away from this is that this is going to be seen as a huge push from the international community in support of the process and as a kind of push for all parties to try to resolve and salvage the remaining deal. However, considering that Santos doesn't have high popularity in Colombia, he's particularly suffering from that right now, I don't think that the Peace Prize is actually going to kind of elevate his standing here in Colombia in terms of your regular Joe's perception of him.
So maybe this increases the prospects for a final deal at some point, maybe not for Santos himself, even though he gets the prestige. Nadia, do Colombians have a national sense of irony at all? I mean, people standing around in Bogota or in the coffee shops, I know they drink a lot of coffee, saying, well, that's awkward, but kind of funny. We voted this thing down, the world knows, and then all of a sudden here's the award, and at least get a chuckle out of it. If you're Colombian, how do you digest this?
Luckily, Colombians do have a very good sense of humor. And there is an expression here that when things start going very, very strange, a lot of people say it is Mekondo. That's referring to a town in the books of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who wrote Magic Realism, where the extraordinary starts to become ordinary. And much of Colombian life has been characterized that way. So you certainly hear that a lot these days, that one day after another, there are rather Mekondo events. But Colombians are used to this. And I think that this is going to be seen as just one irony after a long list of them.
Maybe just another page out of 100 years of solitude that you're referring to there.
Exactly.
So going forward now, if the Nobel Prize award increases pressure towards an eventual ratification of this deal, what's the timeline for renegotiation or the next time the Colombian people with their deep sense of Mekondo get another crack at this?
That's what everyone's asking. We all want to know the timeline. There has been no timeline announced. There has been no announcement in regards of, you know, what aspects of the peace deal might be back on the table, which ones are absolutely, you know, not to be touched for rediscussion. However, both negotiating parties from the government and the FARC will be making an announcement out of Cuba this morning. They are back at the table. So that we might be getting some more news this morning, but so far we are still very much in the dark in terms of, is this renegotiation going to be, is it going to dissect the entire peace agreement? Is it going to touch, you know, just certain elements? And will it take a month or possibly 2 years?
Nadia, I've spent a little bit of time in Bogota myself. I'm going to venture to say Colombians would rather win the World Cup than have their president win the Nobel Peace Prize, but he's won it nonetheless. If it doesn't increase his political prospects, if he's unpopular, what does this mean for Colombian people in terms of their sense of national pride, or not much at all?
I don't think that it will necessarily affect Colombians' pride. I think that for a lot of Colombians that I've spoken to, at least, who voted for the peace accords, they feel that the international community is in a position right now to make fun of them, asking, you know, what country goes through half a century of war and then votes against peace? And so even though, you know, the gesture of a Nobel Peace Prize is very well intentioned towards trying to bolster efforts towards peace, I think that a lot of Colombians will see it as, you know, this is almost like a consolation prize, you know, saying, pat on the back, Santos, you did a good job trying, nice try, but he didn't quite crack it. And hopefully, I think that Colombians will see this as a recognition that what is at stake here is not, you know, political calculations, but the end of a war.
And another page of Mekondo, perhaps, right, Nadia?
Without a doubt.
Mekondo in Colombia, magical realism. When things can't get any more strange, they just get more fantastical. Nadia Drost is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for PBS NewsHour, talking about all of the ironies of a long war in Colombia not voted down, and then a Nobel Peace Prize announced for President Juan Manuel Santos. Nadia Drost, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Todd Zwillick at our partner at The Takeaway.
It's been the talk of the town, the burgeoning startup community in Metro Phoenix, and today it's in the national spotlight as tech pioneer Steve Case's Rise of the Rest tour comes to town. It's a bus tour that CASE's venture capital firm launched a few years ago to bring together local entrepreneurs, investors, and local governments to highlight emerging startup communities around the country. And this morning, the bus rolled into Civic Space Park in downtown Phoenix, and the show's Lauren Gilger was there to meet it, and she's here now. So, Lauren, Rise of the Rest, is that as in the rest of the country?
Exactly. The idea is to spread the wealth when it comes to venture capital around the country to places that aren't just Silicon Valley or New York or Boston. And CASE is literally doing this. In each of the cities on this tour, he's holding a pitch competition between local startups, and he's investing $100,000 in the winner.
So, Lauren, where did the bus take you this morning?
Well, we started downtown, where Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton met CASE in front of their big tour bus.
10 years ago, this wasn't here.
And what was it? Just this kind of rundown neighborhood?
Empty lodge.
Then we all loaded up and made our way to the Desert Botanical Garden, where they met Arizona State University President Michael Crow, and they were met by a virtual who's who of Phoenix's startup community.
Of our fifth Rise the Rest tour.
So we're the last city on the tour, and they chose which cities they would go to this time with a community call to action, sort of crowdsourcing. They got about 1,000 nominations to go to 80 different cities across the country, but Phoenix really stood out.
And Phoenix had the most nominations of any city.
So what does the startup community here have to offer?
Well, I asked CASE and Mayor Stanton about that, and CASE says most people outside of these pockets of emerging entrepreneurs have no idea what's happening in places like Phoenix.
Last year, 75% of venture capital went to three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. 75%. So the other 47 states, including obviously Arizona, are fighting over 25%. And that's crazy. It doesn't reflect the distribution of great entrepreneurs building great companies. It's really more of a historical anomaly. And part of our Rise of the Rest initiative is designed to try to level the playing field so every entrepreneur everywhere kind of has a shot at the American dream and has access to capital to start and scale their company. So having a more inclusive approach to entrepreneurship in both terms of place, like Rise of the Rest, and also people. We're trying to make sure women and people of color also have a more of a level playing field in terms of access to capital and a shot at building great breakout companies all around the country, including places like Phoenix.
So, Mayor Stanton, how did you hear about this tour?
My team in my office aggressively pursued the opportunity for them to come and visit and see our talented people here in Phoenix. Look, in Phoenix, this is an exciting and important time in our history. And our value proposition here in the city of Phoenix is that we have talent that is second to none, but it can be acquired at a price that is much more affordable than some of the other cities where the venture capital is going. And money's gonna find talent. And that's exactly what Steve is promoting right now, is that there are talented people around the country, including here in Phoenix. And the dynamic that's going on is so many Bay Area companies are expanding significant operations into Phoenix, integrating into the existing Yes Phoenix entrepreneurial activity. You got this great dynamic that is happening right now.
There have been a lot of attention kind of coming to the entrepreneurial community here. We've had a couple of articles in the New York Times, but there always seems to be this addendum, like that Arizona isn't the kind of place you expect this to be. We have politics that are controversial. We've had some policies that have made people angry. Are you encountering that as you go to other places? And what do you think about that here?
Well, I think that is a dynamic. It seems like this is a city that has an advantage there because it is a more diverse population than we see in other parts of the country. And sure, the politics tend to get controversial on different kinds of issues. We're just trying to focus on how do you create the companies that create the jobs, that create the economic growth, that lift up all these communities, all these different places.
Look, we have a wonderfully diverse population in Phoenix. We're about to be a majority Latino city. That's a huge strategic advantage as we enter a more global economy. Our local Latino population is younger, it's bilingual, it's an entrepreneurial community. If you look at the recent Datos report from the Hispanic Chamber, it shows that our Latino community is arguably our most entrepreneurial community here locally. All we have to do is harness that talent.
And just to add to that, the mayor said, I think that there's a strategic advantage to places like Phoenix that have a more diverse population. And I understand that immigration is a complex emotional issue, particularly this year and particularly in states like Arizona, and talks of walls and things like that. But from my perspective, if we're going to remain the most innovative entrepreneur nation, we need to win with now a global battle for talent and continue to be a magnet for talent. 40% of our nation's Fortune 500 companies were started by immigrants. Over 40% of Silicon Valley companies were started by immigrants. So we need to be more welcoming and really more inclusive. And states like Arizona, even though I understand that some of the the challenges and some of the sensitivities, it feels like it's well positioned for this next wave because it has a more diverse population. But we need to make sure we are leveling the playing field so that, you know, those folks have a shot at the American dream too and have a shot at creating the jobs that can really lift up these communities.
Well, Mayor Stan and Steve Case, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on tour. It's fun.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. And this afternoon, if you want to join in, you can watch the Rise of the Res pitch competition at the Deuce in Phoenix.
The reach of artificial intelligence in our lives is growing, and its impact is especially great in the realm of national defense. The U.S. is using more drones and other programmed items to pursue adversaries and terrorists. But that has some around the world getting worried about those AI weapons becoming fully autonomous. That's led to an effort by Human Rights Watch called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. A related meeting was held on the subject this week in Great Britain, and Heather Roth, a research scientist with ASU's Global Security Initiative, has testified about the topic before the United Nations, and she's with me now to explain what's going on. Heather, how much of a connection has there been between artificial intelligence and weapon systems in the U.S.?
We've actually relied on artificial intelligence with weapon systems since the 60s. So with missile defense systems, when we're thinking about defense from nuclear armed attack, the height of the Cold War, things like this, most of those systems were run off of a suite of sensors and radars and computers that were networked all throughout the country. You had vast, well, they were expert systems, was what they were called. So they were very kind of if-then statements. If you see this, then do this. So you can think of it like a decision tree going down. And that was a very basic, rudimentary kind of AI.
I think about when I was a kid and President Reagan brought up so-called Star Wars.
Very much so.
Right. And so how much of it has been focused on defense as opposed to more aggressive action on the offensive side?
I think that a lot of what we're seeing now, the progenitor of all of the stuff that we're seeing come to fruition, was started in the early 80s with Star Wars, with the Strategic Defense Initiative and with the Strategic Computing Initiative. And so all of the kind of money that was dumped into the research at the time is really paying off now. So now we're actually seeing it come to market in different ways. A lot of that money was not just focused on defense, but in what I would say novel applications of AI. So DARPA, for example, the Defense Research Projects Agency, you know, some call it the Pentagon's brain, right? They knew, actually in 83 with the SDI, that they needed to get their own pot of money, and they wanted to actually build a human general level intelligence. But they couldn't pitch that to Congress because they said, well, what's the, you know, what's the defense part of this? So what they did was they actually separated it into three different applications that had defense purposes. And so they were projects. So that's a projects agency. And so one of them was a self-driving car. The other one that I like to talk about is the Pilots Associate. And the Pilots Associate is basically a lot of the functions that we see happening now on planes, that the plane takes over for self-monitoring and things like that, a lot of the kind of like autopilot situations. But on fighter jets, a lot of the really fancy stuff, I would say, is coming out now with the F-35. So all of the things that the plane can do by itself that allows the pilot to not have to continually focus on monitoring all of these things, but can monitor the threats in the area. That's what those kind of early projects were from DARPA in the 80s, and they were all directed at artificial intelligence ultimately.
There's concern that this will be, you talked about these, some sort of AI systems being in place since the 60s. This sounds like there's potential and there's concern among some. AI can be used in a more aggressive way in the form of drones, and how much weight are we putting in the devices as opposed to the people programming those devices or whatnot? Do you think there is a legitimate concern that, not that the devices will take over the world, but that the devices are programmed in such a way that either they're not versatile enough, flexible enough, or not smart enough, frankly, to make proper decisions about who a target should be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should kind of just sidebar concerns about, you know, Terminators and super intelligent AI, just kind of sidebar that for the moment, and really concern ourselves with the limitations of AI, because artificial intelligence is limited by the tasks that you can give it. So what kind of task would you want to give an autonomous weapon? And you say, well, I want it to go from point A to point B. You say, okay, I'm okay with that kind of task. It can do self-mobility, self-direction, things like that. But when you say, I want it, you know, I want to field a weapon, I want it to fly wherever I generally give it some directions to, and I want it to find bad people, Well, then the task becomes quite vague. And so this is where I think Human Rights Watch has a very valid concern about the kinds of weapons that we want to deploy and the kinds of decisions that we want to hand over to a machine.
There are a lot of elements involved here, Heather. So where do ethics fit in?
They come into play in judging, having some sort of forethought and foresight about what kind of world you want to live in, and then what kind of principles you want to abide by. And if you say, look, the United States has these values. We do not target civilians. We do not engage in genocide. We do not engage in disproportionate armed force. If we abide by the rules and the laws of armed conflict, if those are our values, and I would say that they are our values, you know, there are points where we have to realign and things, you know, might be drifting and someone has to come back and push them back into place. But for the most part, I would say these are our values. And so you say, if these are our values, then we really need to design for it. We need to prepare for it. And we need to stand up and say we're not going to use them in these types of situations. That may require people on the ground. Mm-hmm. That may require blood and not, you know, robots. Mm-hmm. But that is also the cost of going into war.
Heather Roth is a research scientist with ASU's Global Security Initiative. We've been talking about artificial intelligence and Human Rights Watch's campaign to stop killer robots. And in a check of KJZZ News at 2:39, should you delay getting the flu shot? It's something even the Centers for Disease Control addressed, saying some recent studies raise the possibility that very early vaccination, particularly among the elderly, might reduce protection later in the season. But Dr. Kara Crist with the Arizona Department of Health says don't wait.
Because we have seen cases in October and November and December, and we've seen cases in April, May, and June. So we never know what we're going to see, and it truly is the best protection. Flu kills thousands of people worldwide every year.
Chris says adults 65 and older don't always have a good immune response to the normal flu vaccine. She recommends Fluad, which triggers a stronger immune response and hopefully better protection.
New research suggests the benefits of farmed salmon have decreased significantly in the past 5 years. The study shows levels of beneficial omega-3 oils in the fish has halved in that time. The industry says farmed salmon is still one of the richest sources of beneficial fish oils, but is exploring new ways to stop the further decline in nutritional value. The BBC's Paulup Ghosh reports from a salmon farm in Scotland.
We're now approaching one of the many fish farms in the West Highlands and Islands. This one is in the middle of Loch Leven, just outside Fort William. We arrive on one of the four floating platforms in the middle of this picture postcard lot. The fish farm is surrounded by rugged hills. Salmon leap in their pens, splashing playfully in the gentle Scottish sunlight. I'm greeted by Steve Bracken of Marine Harvest, the company that operates the farm.
The farm today produces about 3,000 tonnes every 18 months or so. So it's not the largest of farms, but it's certainly a very productive farm. Over the years, we've seen an increase in consumption of farmed Atlantic salmon, and that continues to grow today. So you're looking at somewhere in the region of 4 to 5% annual growth.
But that success has created its own problems. One of the biggest selling points of salmon are its beneficial omega-3 fish oils. These are thought to stave off a range of illnesses, including heart disease, arthritis, and diabetes, and they help brain development in children. At Stirling University, researchers led by Professor Douglas Tosher have been analysing the amount of omega-3 in farmed salmon, not just from Scotland, but worldwide.
About 5 years ago, a portion of Atlantic salmon of around about 130 grams was able to deliver 3.5 grams of EPA and DHA. This is actually our weekly recommended intake. Now, the level of omega-3 is about half what it was 5 years ago. Therefore, instead of eating one portion of farmed salmon, we would need to eat two portions of farmed salmon.
This is not something that people should worry about. They shouldn't stop buying farmed salmon.
Absolutely not, because farmed salmon is still just about the best way of getting omega-3 in our diet. Other oily fish like mackerel are also pretty good at delivering omega-3s. All the other fish are much lower than farmed Atlantic salmon, including wild salmon.
It's feeding time back at the fish farm at Loch Leven. A rotating pipe sprays pellets of food into the pens. The salmon get their omega-3 oil from smaller oily fish, such as anchovies, that have been ground up and added to the pellets. Not long ago, 80% of the feed was made up from oily fish. Now it's more like 20%. That's because the growth in demand for farmed salmon has meant that the limited supply of anchovies has to be spread ever thinner. And so salmon all across the world are being fed less of the fish oil and so contain less beneficial omega-3.
There's only so much that we can produce, and they're getting spread thinner and thinner across the whole of aquaculture and all the feeds. If nothing was done, the level of the beneficial omega-3 can only really go down.
At a laboratory hundreds of miles away in southeast England, there might be a solution. Here, omega-3 fish oils are being extracted from seeds of oilseed rape, otherwise known as camelina. Professor Jonathan Napier of Rothamsted Research is developing the crop.
Basically, the production of fish oils is no longer limited by what's available from wild capture out of the oceans. It's also going to be helped by what we can produce by agriculture. So we think this is a great potential solution to help fish farming become more sustainable and also continue to grow as an industry.
But there's a catch. The camelina crop is genetically modified. There's no risk to the fish or indeed anyone who eats the fish, but currently in Europe, it wouldn't go down well with many customers. Back at the fish farm, Steve Bracken of Marine Harvest tells me that GM technology is accepted in China and the US, and it may be something that consumers in Europe may have to consider in the long run.
I think you have to take a very long-term view of this because we're talking about 9 billion people on the planet by 2050. So we've got to be producing more from the sea. Agriculture is being stretched, no doubt about it. So farming in the sea is what it's all about. That's the future.
That was Steve Bracken of Marine Harvest, the company that operates the fish farm, ending our report from the BBC's Palab Ghosh.
The popularity of jazz has been in flux for decades. Though it's a unique American art form, the challenge of attracting younger generations of fans continues. There was good news for Valley Jazz aficionados, though, when the National Jazz Forward Coalition recently selected Phoenix as one of its partners in the Jazz Hub initiative. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a jazz scholar about the current state of the genre. We start with Joel Robin Goldenthal, executive director of the NASH, the Phoenix Jazz Venue, and longtime leader of Jazz in Az. And Joel, what was the Jazz Hub designation all about?
The whole purpose of this program is to develop best practices and take what's been working in silos around the country and promote this model across the country so that jazz can get some traction in America.
And how did the Hub come into play?
Well, the Jazz Hub is a project of an organization called the Jazz Forward Coalition, which is a new organization that was inspired to be created when they saw the headline "Jazz is Dead" in the Wall Street Journal. And the purpose of the Hub project is to develop a knowledge base for how to build and promote jazz community in the country. Jazz is no secret has been struggling, and one of the great things about Phoenix is we have all of these wonderful jazz assets. The NASH has been so successful because it kind of held out the space in the universe for all these jazz assets to come together. So what we're going to do through this project is these four hubs who were chosen not so much for their geographic diversity, but more for the different flavors that they bring to it. We have the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., which has been around, you know, forever and has a government component to it. You have the Manchester Craftsman Guild in Pittsburgh. We have the Portland Jazz Festival, so you have a festival component. And then you have the new kids on the block, who in 4 years have just set the world on fire with building jazz community.
How important is the actual live performance of music? And is in the case of jazz, is it even more important?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Jazz is a live, in-person, intimate art form. I like to be argumentative and say, once it's on a CD, it's not jazz anymore because you lose the spontaneous component to it. The extraordinary dynamism and give and take between the audience and the artist is something that's palpable, and we hear it. You hear it from a student, and you hear it from somebody that's been doing it all their life. Everybody says the same thing in the first 30 seconds about the experience of being at the NASH. It's amazing.
How do you get more young people interested in it?
Students are always going to find their way into this art form, you know, and I have a theory that, you have a jazz gene, and you either have it or you don't, and if you have it, it gets excited, you know, when you're exposed to it. So the fundamental key is exposure, and we are, as we speak here, looking for investigating new ways to expose more and more young people to jazz. I mean, in a perfect world, jazz would pop up in the middle of a football game and every place and say, people say, I like that. What is that? Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, most people have preconceived notions about what jazz is. Sometimes with kids, it comes from peer pressure, you know, that's not any music that they want any part of. That's old people's music. And unfortunately, you know, even people that have been around for a long time had a bad exposure to jazz. Something that, when I say bad, I mean they heard a form of the music that didn't resound with them. Because you can, you know, it could be extremely melodic, or it could be extremely dissonant. It can be extremely rhythmic, or it can have absolutely no form at all.
Joel Robin Goldenthal is executive director of the Nash, which marks its fourth anniversary this weekend with special shows on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
That issue of exposure to jazz is also on the mind of Wayne Winborn. He's executive director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. And Wayne, it seems as though there's this perception out there that jazz as a genre of music is struggling right now. Do you buy into that?
Not really. I mean, typically when people say that, you phrase it very nicely, they typically say jazz is dead. And media outlets, as well as individuals, like to trumpet that fact. We joke around here that, you know, people declare jazz dead every 2 or 3 years or so. And then the next year, of course, they declare it alive because someone has a what could be considered a hit record. It's no question that in terms of recorded music that is sold, jazz is the least paid for. But I think if you look at other indicators, I mean, just a cross-section of other outcomes, if you will, jazz is thriving. Jazz is heard more and more, I think, today than it has been in recent years. Commercials feature jazz all the time. Classical musicians study jazz, incorporate jazz elements into their music. Rock and pop and folk musicians, and certainly hip-hop musicians, sample jazz cuts. And so there's a lot of jazz that people hear. They may not be going out and explicitly buying a mainstream jazz CD, but I think jazz is much, much more integrated into mainstream musical life than it has ever before.
Does it make as big of an impact on musicians, maybe on the industry of jazz music itself, if people are hearing the music but maybe not aware of the fact that they're hearing it, as opposed to downloading an album, going and buying an album or streaming it on a streaming service?
Oh, it makes a big difference, and you've put your finger on something. I mean, so you have folks who don't think they like jazz, or if they don't think they like current or contemporary jazz or mainstream jazz today, but they'll have several Miles Davis records in their collection or Duke Ellington records. As well they should. These are classics. But they're unaware of some of the masters that are among us and some of the young and emerging artists and the vital music that they're creating.
Since streaming has become so popular for a lot of people in a lot of genres, does that in a way present an opportunity for jazz to try to maybe reach a new audience and maybe not have to worry about record sales?
Oh, I think absolutely. The biggest thing is that it closes the gap between the artist and the listener and their audience. And I would say it broadens the audience. So at any given moment, you can have your music, your, you know, whatever you're presenting or whatever you've created at that moment before a global audience.
In your mind, has jazz become or is jazz becoming more of a niche kind of market as opposed to sort of broad mass appeal?
I think it's always been a niche kind of market. I don't know that it was ever, you know, sort of wildly popular. I don't so much ponder or worry about it becoming, you know, that broadly known. Jazz requires something of the listener. You have to engage with the music. You have to engage with the art at a different level. And I don't know that that's ever going to be something that the masses of people choose to do. I'm okay with that. What I would like to see is it being more popular. I mean, I think it's tapping a fraction of its potential audience.
So it sounds like you're less concerned about jazz reaching like Taylor Swift and Adele levels, but maybe something more in line with where jazz has traditionally been or maybe a little bit higher.
Absolutely. We have musicians today who are creating music that is worthy of being dealt with, that aesthetically is pleasing, but is also, I would dare say, consciousness raising, that's going to evoke emotions of you, that are music that's of this time. I want this music to be in their ears. I want it to be in their homes. You know, I want them to be supporting these musicians. That's a concern for me, as opposed to, you know, reaching Taylor Swift numbers. I don't see that. That's a different, you know, it's a different thing.
Wayne Winborn is executive director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. Gather under the big top, popcorn in one hand, cotton candy in the other, and prepare to be amazed by daring acrobatics and feats of strength.
That is the circus archetype, and maybe it's where a couple clowns like us, Mark, belong, but circus has since gone to new heights. Just look at the wildly popular Cirque du Soleil shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, do you want to feed alive?
It's still got that wow factor, but there are other emotions at play in circus acts today.
Like, you know, sad clowns?
Think more like a performance that's filled with ups and downs, just like life. That's what one local circus troupe tries to bring out in its performances. Each act is part of a larger story, like a circus within a play. The show's Annika Klein spoke with one of the performers who decided to use a very personal experience in her next act.
My name is Haley Daugherty, but my stage persona is Widow Ives.
Daugherty is an aerialist with the Gaslight Circus. That means she climbs and dances on cloth hanging from the top of the stage. It looks like a pair of extra long, silky red bedsheets.
It looks like we're lined up. We've got mimes and fire eaters and fire spitters and fire dancers.
Play some notes for a second, Noah. Go ahead and crank it.
This is rehearsal for the circus troupe at the Alwyn House in Phoenix.
So we really come together to try to put on narrative storytelling shows.
So tell me about this show coming up.
Our upcoming show is called Noir. It's very Dante's Inferno in that this young girl is dealing with terminal illness and is coming to terms with what that means through her Virgil-type guide, who is actually a clown instead of a great philosopher. Not that the two are mutually exclusive. And we are kind of acting around her and sort of guiding her through this challenging experience that people have to deal with in real life.
Take me back to this experience that is kind of informing the performance for you.
When I was in fifth grade, my mother almost died of a brain tumor. When we took her to Barrow Neurological Institute, they told us if we had come in a couple days later that she would have died, and there was nothing that they could have done to help her at that point. It was about the size of a tangerine when all was said and done, and they pulled the brain tumor out. And considering how small a human brain is, that's a really terrifying prospect.
Was it a turning point for you in your childhood to go through that experience, that very adult, scary experience?
I think the real turning point wasn't until sixth grade when we had this horrible little school play. Those school plays that they make everybody participate in and all the little kids have to sing, and only like 3 out of the 20 kids know how to sing. And it was absolutely terrible. Nobody knew what they were doing. But my mom was there in the back row just sobbing her eyes out because she was saying, I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy that I was around to see this horrible little school play. And that's kind of when it sunk in that everything was going to be a little bit different from now on.
How does all this translate to the performance? You're taking all these emotions, this huge range of emotions, and translating it to the stage. Tell me about that.
I am blindfolded. My character has lost her sight. It's that darkness that goes with looking into the unknown, because that, what if she isn't here? What if my mother had died? That's the great big black unknown. And go into not having those fluid, pretty, solid moves that I usually have in silks, but those stopping, jittery, and really harsh, rough movements that come with not knowing what's going on, not knowing where you are, not knowing how things are going to move forward.
Again, pry the belly, hook and a nail.
First with shovel, then with bone.
During rehearsal, Daugherty wears the blindfold. She holds herself up 10 feet above the stage floor, raveling and unraveling her limbs in the silks. The song is a number from a favorite horror musical.
Oh.
there is a move in gymnastics and aerial silks called the Iron Cross. You wrap the silks around each one of your arms and then extend them as far out as you can. And the point is to try to be completely straight like a cross. And it's that being vulnerable moment where it's just my arms are the only thing keeping me up. And that is, I think, the most powerful moment in the performance.
Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia.
That silence is everyone holding their breath as Doherty allows herself to quickly unravel from the silk. She drops, almost to the stage floor, but suddenly the cloth catches her.
Woo! Woo! Brava, brava.
My performance is a painting, and the painting itself is not of me, but my experiences and my emotions, those are the paints that I'm using. So when people first look at it, they're not gonna see the individual paints, they're gonna see the final product.
And if you're wondering, her mom will be at this performance too. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
The Gaslight Circus will perform tomorrow at the Alwyn House.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.